2003. And we are going to start out this morning by opening a work session on House Bill 2491. Mr. Tatton.
House Bill 2491 directs members of Board of Commissioners of Port to file annual statement of economic interest with the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission. There are no amendments. The bill has no fiscal or revenue impact as far as those offices are concerned.
The chair would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that we send House Bill 2491 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves that we send House Bill 2491 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Given Representative Betsy Johnson's very clear and graphic description of this bill as being prophylactic, that would provide the opportunity to protect and inhibit bad things from happening, I am prepared to vote yes on this bill.
Very good. Other discussion?
Can't stop that one.
All right.
Representative Dingfelder says can't top that one, so we'll call the roll, please.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Excuse.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Brock.
Excuse.
Chair Jensen.
Aye. Having received the constitutional majority, 2491 is referred to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Flores, would you like to carry that?
Oh, thank you for the opportunity. I hope Representative Flores will explain prophylactic when she...
I have the best description written, so...
When you carry this on the floor, you'll have to include that in your...
Indeed.
Thank you, Representative. At this point, we will... Have we closed that? Close the work session on 2491 and open a work session on House Bill 2226.
House Bill 2226 eliminates exemption for utility regulation for water utilities that serve fewer than 300 customers, provides a water utility that serves fewer than 500 customers and that is of any charges average and has any charges average annual resident rate of $18 per month or more is thereafter subject to regulation by Public Utilities Commission except for financial regulation, provides that association that provides water to members of association and that is not public utility may be regulated as public utility upon petition of 20% of its members of the association, exempt cooperatives and public bodies. Again, there's no fiscal or revenue indication on this bill at the present time. There are no amendments.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder.
I move that we send House Bill 2226 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dingfelder moves House Bill 2226 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? We'll call the roll, please.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Excuse.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative
Tomei.
Aye.
Representative
Dingfelder. Aye.
Representative
Croft.
Excuse.
Chair
Jensen. Aye.
Okay.
Calendar. The chair was thinking about this. While I think it's a probably a bill that will receive the support of the House pretty completely. The nature of the being the Public Utility Commission, and any what is perceived as regulatory body then may deserve a floor speech on it, an explanatory speech on it on the floor. So,
I'd be happy to carry it if you.
Thank you, Representative Dingfelder. Representative Dingfelder will carry the bill then. House Bill 2226 is having received the majority is moved to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Representative Dingfelder will carry the bill. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2226. Colleagues, we have House Bill 2227 scheduled for work session, and you will recall this is a companion bill with 2226. The amendments that we needed for that bill that the commission requested, while we got amendments back, were not exactly what we requested, and we are therefore going to hold that over until we get the appropriate amendments for it. So we will not be having a work session on House Bill 2227 this morning. But we will open then a work session on House Bill 2456.
House Bill 2456 modifies provisions relating to voluntary program for allocation of conserved water. Allows persons or groups of persons implementing measures prior to application for allocation of conserved water to apply for allocation if measure was implemented within 5 years of application. Declares emergency effective on passage. There is no indication of fiscal or revenue issues with this bill, at least at the present time. There was one amendment that was discussed at the last meeting that was more of a correction of a change that legislative council had made to the bill that was unintentional, and its two words have been added back into the bill, and they should be in your packets, committee members. We've got to get some copies made for the audience. But basically, on page 3 of the printed bill, line 31, restore the bracketed material and delete the maybe. That you will have to deal with in this work session.
Okay. Can you tell us who was the group that was advocating for this bill?
Yes, Chairman Jensen, this is a bill that is the result of the work of the Senate Bill 93 Task Force, or group that was set up in, I think, 1997. To review the state's water management, make suggestions and changes necessary to help us continue to have water into the future.
Okay. I would.
Want a motion?
Yeah, we need a motion on the amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash. These are dash ones, correct?
Okay.
Dash ones amendments to House Bill 2456.
Representative Dingfelder moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2456. Is there any discussion on that or the amendments? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder.
I move House Bill 2456 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dingfelder moves House Bill 2456 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? As amended?
As amended.
As amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative
Chopler. Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative
Croft.
Chair Jensen.
Aye. Having served on the Senate Bill 93 Task Force for some four long years, the chair will carry that bill at this time. So, having received the Constitutional majority, House Bill 2456, as amended, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We will close the work session on House Bill 2456 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2475.
Chair Jensen and committee members, House Bill 2475 directs county assessor to verify that not more than one owner of land owned by multiple parties has signed nomination petition or voted at assembly of electors for purposes of nominating a candidate for irrigation district board directors. Specifies that recall petitions relating to directors of an irrigation district must be filed with a district board of directors and not the county clerk if petition may not be filed with district secretaries. This bill has no fiscal or revenue report that would indicate a problem there, and it is public hearing.
Okay. We have a... Please come ahead, Representative. And my apologies, Representative Nelson. I was touched. I was not aware that you were here to testify on a bill, or we would have opened this earlier.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Chair Jensen and members of the House Committee on Water, I thank you for your consideration today of House Bill 2475. I'm State Representative Donna Nelson from District 24. The purpose of this bill is simple: two minor corrections in existing law pertaining to irrigation districts. This bill was drafted at the request of the Oregon Association of County Clerks and has no fiscal or revenue impacts. House Bill 2475 simply directs county assessors to verify that not more than one owner of land owned by multiple parties is counted as voting on nomination petitions or at assemblies held for the purposes of forming an irrigation district prior to filing. The bill also directs recall petitions to be filed with the district board of directors if there is no filing officer, or in cases where the filing officer is actually the subject of the recall. These common sense alterations simply clarify existing law. I thank you for your consideration and support. And I have to my left one of my youngest constituents who's here to testify today. And on my right, I have the greatly respected, beloved, intelligent, genius County Clerk of Yamhill County. And I hope you'll ask him the questions that you may have.
Thank you, and with the introduction of the county clerk from Yamhill County, we appreciate that, but you will forgive us if we ask Vicki to, I believe it's Vicki, is that correct, to go ahead, everyone. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Committee, I'm Vicki Fetters of Amity, Oregon. I'm here to support House Bill 2475. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Vicki? No questions. What grade in school are you, Vicki?
I'm in seventh grade.
Seventh grade?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me say that we really appreciate you coming down here to testify before us and to learn, I think, maybe a little bit in the process about the process of government in our state, how it works, and what it's like. So we wish more young people like yourself would be able to come and participate as you have. Thank you very kindly.
Thank you.
Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to take my cue from Vicki. I'm here to support the bill. Thank you very much. I'm Charles Sternier. I'm Hill County Clerk. You know, it's after the introduction that Representative Nelson gave me, I'm afraid to answer any questions. But water districts, or irrigation districts, are kind of a different creature in that it's a district the county clerks, after they're formed, are really not involved in any of their elections. And so this kind of goes and looks at, I think the one that gets the most action in central and eastern Oregon is the recall issue. And so it, instead of putting it back to the clerk, which is kind of an anomaly for them, it leaves it with the district to manage the recall. Recalls. And the issue on formation is it's not such a big issue, but while we were doing some cleanup, we felt that should be cleaned up too. And so I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any questions? Probably just kind of a general question. I know this came from the county clerks, as Representative Nelson indicated. Were there any kind of specific problems that precipitated this as far as the clerks were concerned, or is it just kind of a general ongoing situation?
Chair Jensen, I don't have any of these types of districts in Yamhill County, and so I had to be educated by my good brother and sister on the east side of the mountains about these districts, that what it really related to. And there were some recalls, I think, in Deschutes County and some of those counties over there, in which it kind of brought the election process back to the clerk, where the district didn't want it to go there because they do their own balloting and their own system of maintaining who's eligible to vote. And Susie Penhall of Deschutes County was one of the main movers of why we needed this bill. You have me in front of you because I'm closer to Salem than is Bend, and so that's why I'm here. But that's my understanding of it. The issue of filing the petition for the formation was just, you know, while we're here, because what happens now, we get the petition, take the assessor, say, you know, do we have more than one property owner? Then it comes back to us. And once it's filed with us, then they can't make changes to it. By going to the assessor and clarifying get his certificate, then it hadn't been filed with us yet, and so the clock doesn't start on that. So that was kind of just a why we were there type thing.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you.
And thank you, Vicki. We appreciate your being here. And then we have Christina McNitt from the Oregon Water Resource Congress. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Christina McNitt with the Oregon Water Resources Congress, which you may recall is a trade association of irrigation districts, so this bill would directly affect our members. And I'm basically here to follow Ms. Vicki and the greatly loved, highly intelligent, talented, and well-respected county clerk of Yamhill County and lend our support to this bill. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions from Ms. McNitt?
Yes. Christina, do you know of problems that had arisen that precipitated this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, we're not aware of any particular problems. I think this was just the County Clerks Association has an association that goes through election laws on a periodic basis, and it's my understanding that they were just looking at recall issues and kind of stumbled across this, and they reached out to us and communicated with us and made sure that it was fine with our members, and we ran it through the process, and we're appreciative of the input.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on House Bill 2475? Okay. Seeing no one else, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2475. And then at this point, we have an informational meeting. And I see where Pretty good time on this, Adam. So Mr. Sussman from the Water Resources Department will be here to enlighten us about what is water marketing and how does it work, and then an update on the Deschutes Basin groundwater mediation plan that is in progress. So,
I don't know how much I said, Donna. I saw her come in and didn't think to tell you either.
I did. Good morning, Adam. How are you this morning?
I'm fine, Chair Jensen. Beautiful weather we're having today. Adam Sussman from the Water Resources Department. I tried to get my fourth grader to come and give this presentation, but she didn't want to miss the tetherball tournament, so maybe I'll get her another time.
We'll be waiting for that other time.
This morning, I was asked to come and talk to the committee about two separate but interrelated topics. One, which is what is water marketing, and then second, what are some of the things that are going on, and an update in the Deschutes Basin. And it's really not about a mediation plan. It's actually about the mitigation requirements for groundwater use in the basin, which I'll get to. And so what I've provided you is two separate memos that might provide you the kind of information you're looking for. With respect to water marketing, I'm not going to come up here and profess that I'm an expert in water marketing, but I do know enough to answer the questions both posed by the chair and the committee administrator, which is, you know, what is water marketing, what's going on in general in the western United States, and what are some activities specifically in Oregon. And so I thought I could walk you through this memo. We've been in front of this committee a number of times, and we've talked about how surface water is fully allocated and groundwater is not an inexhaustible resource. And we've also talked about how the surface water sources have a number of issues, Endangered Species Act, water quality, and other things. And for that reason, in Oregon as well as in the rest of the western United States, water marketing is emerging as a tool to sort of find new supplies of water. And what it really does is reallocate the existing water supplies. So the first question, what is water marketing? Just right out of a number of different treaties you'll find on water marketing, is that it's the transfer, the exchange, the lease, or the sale of water rights from one user to another. And in many cases, to sort of facilitate this movement of water rights from one user to another, banks are formed. And those banks sort of serve as a place where people can both deposit and acquire water rights. Now, why the interest in water reallocation? There's a number of reasons. For municipal and industrial water users, they need to find water to support economic development and population. And in many cases, for those municipal water suppliers, getting water reallocated to them is more affordable, more timely, and more doable in terms of getting new supply as compared to coming in and going through a new water right permitting process. From the environmental perspective, a water market's a means to acquire water rights to restore stream flow and improve water quality. And in many articles on water marketing, people will argue that a water market actually results in people using water more efficiently because it begins to allow people to understand the value of the resource that they have. For water users, of course, water markets are a way to facilitate and augment existing water supplies and to deal with the increasing requirements from the Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act, or to provide for mitigation for new water uses. And again, I mentioned water banks, which is really just an institutional agreement where people deposit a water right, someone can withdraw it, for a specified period or a specified price. And in California and Idaho, there are statewide water banks, while other states like Oregon, we do have banks, but they're more on a kind of a regional or even project basis. And I'll get to the Schutz Bank as I move forward. So that's kind of in a nutshell what water marketing is. What are some of the concerns? Because as you can imagine, water marketing is not a panacea or would be prevalent, and it's not. In Oregon, one of the big issues that is raised comes from irrigated agriculture. And in the state of Oregon, irrigated agriculture holds about 80% of the existing allocated water, which accounts for about 1.8 million acres of irrigated land in the state of Oregon. And historically, irrigators have been able to acquire and apply water beneficially and not be subject to the market forces, if you will, of the price of the water. And the main concern raised once by a intelligent man, now the committee administrator for this committee, is that the agriculture just cannot compete economically on an open market for water. I mean, that's the concern. So when water is sold to the highest bidder, the concern is that agriculture will lose both individually and collectively. And they're also concerned that if you take water out of agricultural use and move it to some other use, it will never come back to that agricultural use. We've also heard concerns raised by irrigation districts who are concerned that individual patrons may decide that they want to market their water, and that can, of course, cause conflicts between the water user and the district, and can adversely affect assessment base, efficiency, and other users within the district. Now, attached to the memo, I've provided some tables and some statistics.
Adam, could you explain a little bit how that could affect their assessment base and reduce efficiency of the delivery operations?
Yes, Chair Jensen, Representative Tomei. There's some healthy tension today between irrigators, districts, and other water users about this whole question about who is the owner of a water right. Does the district own it? Does the individual within the district own it? And there could be a situation, a real situation that I'm thinking of in Southern Oregon, where a member of a district whose water right makes up about two-thirds of the assessment base of that district, if they were interested in marketing their water, say, to an in-stream use, the district could potentially lose the ability to assess that individual for their water right. They might transfer it in-stream and then maybe exclude themselves even from the district. So the districts are very concerned about trying to maintain the base, if you will, of the irrigated land so that they can maintain their assessment base. That would be in terms of the assessment base. In terms of their efficiency, a hypothetical water user could be at the very end of a delivery system, and if they were to market their water to some other use and no longer needed that water to irrigate their land, that could really affect the carrying capacity of that ditch, because now they no longer have that individual's water to help carry water to the end of the ditch, and that can adversely affect users within the system. So those are just a couple examples of how marketing of a water right outside of a district could affect a district.
Thank you, Adam. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I was mentioning we provided some information attached to the memo, and some of this information I think you've been provided previously, but I just wanted to point out some statistics because although water marketing is going on in Oregon, at least to date, it hasn't been a huge activity, and the effect on irrigated agriculture, at least to date, seems to be fairly small. And if you look at those statistics, I think it's the very last page, over the last 5 years, we show how irrigation water rights have been moved from one use to another. And based on our information, irrigation water rights have been moved to, say, municipal use at the expense of about 1,100 acres of irrigated land in Oregon. And again, that's compared to the 1.8 million acres of irrigated land we have in the state. Also, if you look at the statistic of irrigation water rights being changed and moved to in-stream uses permanently, that's about less than 1,500 acres, again, compared to the 1.8 million. So at least over the last 5 years, the kind of changes that we've seen have been pretty small, and it results in about 0.1% of irrigated agriculture being changed to either municipal or in-stream uses. Now that's sort of the trend in Oregon, but in the western United States, there's a lot of active water markets. And in the memo, we talk about an article in a publication called The Water Strategist, who this publication analyzes water marketing in the western United States. And in 2002, there were about 200 what they define as major water marketing transactions that took place, again, selling, exchanging, or leasing water. And in the western United States, those major transactions were mostly moving water out of agricultural use to municipal use, again, to satisfy growing populations and growing economic development activities. It also reported that there was a number of transactions to augment agricultural water supplies, as well as a number of transactions for what they call public trust purposes or in-stream purposes. What was really interesting in this article about analysis from 2002 is that the price paid for water varied wildly throughout the western United States. It was as low as $3 an acre foot for Snake River flow augmentation from some storage projects in Idaho, and about $8 an acre foot for some irrigation water from some federal projects in Oregon, and up to over $15,000 an acre foot for Truckee River water rights in Nevada. So you can see the cost varies considerably depending on where you are, what the use is, and probably what the water conditions are as well. So that's kind of a snapshot of kind of what's going on in the western United States in general.
Mr. Chair, who would pay $15,000 an acre foot, and what for what purpose? Do you know that? I mean, we buy water and we pay $7, and obviously it's not for ag. Who's it for?
Yeah, my guess, Chair Jensen, Representative Cruz, is likely for a municipal use would be my guess. And again, because
Reno. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Well, they've got money.
Yeah, they do. Chair Jensen?
The moral of the story is we need some casinos on the adjacent to your land. So.
I'll vote for that.
Well, there's just been kidding. Discussions, but that's...
Yes, sir.
Thank you. On this, on the change in character of use in the past 5 years, this big jump to 33,000 acres and the 32,800 is wildlife and extended. What is that one specific project, and where is that?
Yeah, Chair Jensen, Representative Schaffler, this is always the problem with showing numbers, is that there's lots of different things to explain. But in this case, this is one particular request for a change in type of use for the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. And what the refuge had done was taken approximately 33,000, 32,000 acres of irrigation and changed the character of use to sort of a multi-purpose use called wildlife refuge management. And so that just kind of shows this big change. But refuge wildlife management, of course, includes lots of irrigation.
Thank you.
Yes. So in terms of Oregon specific activities, the state of Oregon does not have a state-operated water market or a state-operated water bank, but that doesn't mean that there aren't transactions going on. And in fact, there are numerous informal water marketing arrangements and transactions occurring that are mostly facilitated by nonprofit organizations. Now, some of these organizations have probably been in front of this committee before. For example, we have the Oregon Water Trust, which is a private nonprofit group that uses a voluntary kind of market-based approach to enhance stream flow, and they use largely in-stream leases, but again, they also do some water right transfers. We also have the Deschutes Water Exchange, which is a nonprofit water marketing organization which is dedicated to stream flow restoration, and what they do is provide services for fees to clients to help market water rights and invest the profit of that activity into their mission, which is to restore stream flow and water quality in the Deschutes Basin. If you're surfing on the web tonight, you can also go to OregonWaterRights.com, which is a web page that's sponsored by some for-profit groups in cooperation with the Deschutes Water Exchange. And through that web page, you can actually find out who in your area is selling water rights, how to sell your water right, and how you might acquire a new water right, particularly in the Deschutes Basin that requires mitigation. Now, we do have our first mitigation bank in the Deschutes Basin as of February, and I'll talk about the whole Deschutes Basin activity in just a couple minutes. But the purpose of that bank is really to facilitate transactions among holders of those who have mitigation credits with those that need credits in order to acquire a new water right. Another water banking recent development is the 2003 Klamath Project pilot, what they call Environmental Water Bank, which should provide about 50,000 acre feet for environmental purposes. And the way this bank, which by the way was developed by the Department of Interior and the Klamath water users or in association with them, gets deposits put in it from individuals in the basin idling their land and or using groundwater. And by doing that, they predict about 50,000 acre feet of water will be deposited into Upper Klamath Lake, which will help meet objectives within the lake for the endangered suckers, which will help meet objectives downstream for coho salmon, and will also help the Bureau stretch the water supply for the project. So those are some of the kind of more exciting Oregon-specific activities that are occurring. And then I guess finally to sum it up, to date really in Oregon, our involvement in water marketing has been to provide tools to individuals to voluntarily move water from one use to another. And in the memo we've described some of these tools, a number of which we've talked about in front of the committee before. We have tools such as water right exchanges. We have water right transfers, which can be either permanent, temporary, or time limited. We have water right leases, which we've talked quite a bit about in front of the committee. We have the opportunity to conserve water and to allocate and market the conserved water. And we also have some opportunities for water reuse, both from municipal water use and from industrial water use from groundwater. So that's really been the state's main involvement in water marketing, again, is sort of providing the tools. So as the water resources in the state become tighter and tighter, I think we'll see a lot more interest in water marketing as a tool for economic development and environmental enhancement activities. And while we in the state of Oregon have a number of innovative tools to move water around, our water market is really in its infancy as compared to some of the other arid states in the West. So hopefully we can learn by some of their successes, learn by some of their mistakes, and as we move forward, do the right thing for the state.
Are there questions?
Are you going to discuss the Deschutes?
I do have a question
about how you're evaluating the effectiveness of the mitigation banks that we have in place. So if you're going to speak to that, that would be helpful.
I'll launch into my discussion of the Deschutes if there's no other questions. And Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, I guess I should say right out of the chute that in terms of the evaluation of the mitigation bank, we're a ways off from that only because the first mitigation bank was just chartered last month. And in fact, I don't even believe the charter has been signed between the department and the bank. So we've got a ways to go in terms of our learning curve and how it's going to move forward.
That would be in the Deschutes area?
Yes, that's correct. Let me, this is a challenge for me because I know some on the committee are rather familiar with the events in the Deschutes Basin and some are not. So I thought the best way to approach this is to kind of tell you the story of kind of how it started and how it ended. And it spans actually over 30 years of time, but I think I can do it in about 10 minutes or less.
We would hope not 30 years.
No. Although I feel like I've been talking about it for 30 years. In September, the Water Resources Commission adopted some groundbreaking rules that have to do with mitigation for groundwater use in the Deschutes Basin, and also some rules that allow the development of mitigation credits and mitigation banks. And this was at the end of a very, very long process. And really what these rules do are implement two different statutes. One statute they implement is Senate Bill 1033, which is from the 1995 session, and the other law that they implement is House Bill 2184, which is from the 2001 session, which is the bill that allowed the development of credits and banks. But let me walk you through the story here. And it goes back to 1970, and this is all sort of... Yes.
Adam, just a quick question for you. Since we brought up the subject of beneficial use, and I understand in the Malheur Refuge that Water Resources is being criticized to some extent for perhaps allowing transfers, and you're being criticized, as I understand it, by certain groups that you are in essence creating a new beneficial use by allowing those transfers. How do you respond to that? In fact, I'm being told that there's a potential of a lawsuit against you for doing so.
Well, Chair Jensen, Representative Krupp, you're accurate in that we are being criticized for that transfer from, say, irrigation to wildlife refuge management. And the way we have approached that issue and in working with the our AG's office, what we have said is that a beneficial use, there is not an inclusive list of beneficial uses in the statute, but rather we have been told that a beneficial use is a thing. It is a way in which you use water. And it's defined, we have rules of the Water Resources Commission that define beneficial use. And there are a number of beneficial uses of water that are out there today that are not specifically defined in statute. And so the way we've approached it is to say there is not an inclusive list.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. But I would assume the people who are criticizing and potentially litigating are basing part of their position on the fact that it is in a body of law someplace as far as beneficial use, and that you're adding a new beneficial use without the benefit of the body of law, I guess. Is that correct? Is that the right assumption?
Well, Chair Jensen, yes, I think there is an argument that the statutes include lists of types of beneficial uses, and those are the types that the department should be issuing permits for. But on the other hand, we have requests for uses that are not in that list. We once had a request for a worm farm, which I don't believe you would find in the statute, which was, you know, a use of water to keep some material wet so that the worms could reproduce. And I know that's a really crazy example, but I use it to clarify that as times change, I think we'll find more and more creative and innovative uses of water that may not be specifically listed in statute, and to limit ourselves to some of the general types of uses listed in statute could be very problematic. And again, we've interpreted the law to tell us that a beneficial use is a way of using water rather than a specific type of use.
It looks to me like Representative Cruz is about to want to ask a question.
No, I was just going to point out, Mr. Chair, that we codified worm farms in 97. But,
that's true.
Yeah. Okay.
I want to follow this just a step or two further. It is then my assumption that the department has taken a position based on the department's interpretation of this issue, that it was unnecessary to come to the legislature to seek some modification or liberalization of the interpretation, or to add anything specific to the concept of beneficial uses. Is that correct?
Well, Chair Jensen, as I said earlier, the use requested is clearly consistent with the notion of beneficial use of water. And in fact, the use requested in this case, the wildlife refuge management, is really sort of a generic term for a umbrella of multiple uses, all of which are in fact listed in the statute: irrigation, wildlife, fish, road watering, a number of other things. It's just the sort of the umbrella term. Wildlife refuge management is not in statute, and again, we felt as if we had clear statutory authority and direction to go ahead and move forward with that type of change.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Would the chair like to continue with the Deschutes?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you for the question. So I was starting back in 1970, where by ballot initiative, we adopted the concept of scenic waterways. And scenic waterways in that act declares that the highest and best use of water within a scenic waterway is fish, wildlife, and recreation uses, and that the free-flowing character of these rivers should be that we should maintain enough water in these rivers for those particular uses. And in the 1970 Act, they did in fact designate a state scenic waterway on various portions of the Deschutes River, including the lower Deschutes River. And then sort of moving forward through time in 1987, which we've talked about with the committee before, we had the State In-Stream Water Rights Act, which created in-stream water rights.
Got it?
Yes.
If we go to, and it strikes me we've got a lot of this sort of thing in especially the water laws, but and maybe some of the environmental things. What happens if we have some type of a major catastrophic event, or a major change in an economic philosophy, or need as far as the state is concerned with this 1970 Oregon Scenic Waterway Act that make it something that therefore makes it impossible to maintain a free-flowing river or stream, as the case may be for it. What are there any provisions?
Well, Chair Jensen, the free flowing character, I don't believe would preclude some natural intervention, if you will, that somehow affected how the river flowed. I think the act is more aimed at this is a free flowing stretch of river that in terms of constructing a artificial obstruction across it is something that the state, through the ballot initiative process, has said that they wanted to protect the free-flowing nature of that river, and that at least at that time it wasn't in the state's sort of public policy interest to build something.
1960s in Montana, the Madison River was a free-flowing river. And I realize this may date me, or for some of you that don't go back there, but there was a major earthquake in the Yellowstone Park area, and an entire side of the mountain slid down, and the Madison River no longer was a free-flowing river.
Right.
What happens with our Scenic Waterway Act if this is to similar event is to occur in the state of Oregon?
Chair Jensen, I don't really have a good answer to that. It hasn't happened yet, and I guess we'll have
it
to...
It has happened, just not in Oregon.
Correct, in Oregon is what I meant to say.
Mr. Chair, it has happened in Oregon, but not in recorded history.
Yes.
Not since we had the 1970 Scenic Waterway.
That's right.
Correct.
Not since I've been on the Water Committee.
And not since I worked at the Water Resources Department. So I don't really have a good answer to that question.
Well, I did, and this is a fairly serious concern of the chair. It seems to me, as I encounter more and more of these things, that we have some body of law that doesn't have any kind of protection or provisions or ways for us to deal with these issues without, of course, coming back in here and realizing that we've had a natural disaster and make some new legislation. Just an area of concern, and I trying to figure some sort of a way out or around some of these things.
Right. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Let me just fast forward and say that we had the...
We don't have to fast
forward. Okay. We don't have to fast forward too much. We've got the Scenic Waterway designated in 1970. In 1988, there was a lawsuit that went all the way up to the Supreme Court, which basically said you can't divert water that would otherwise enter a scenic waterway unless the requirements of the Scenic Waterway Act are being met. And this is affectionately known as the Dyack case. So that was one of the main holdings of the case. But the other thing that case did is sent the department into motion to try to figure out, well, what quantity of water should be in the river to protect fish, wildlife, and recreation uses. And so we spent a number of years studying the state scenic waterways around the state, trying to define basically what those flows should be. And for the Deschutes River, we determined that in 1991 and set those flows. As time went on, a number of events continued. In 1993, there was a groundwater study in the Deschutes Basin that was initiated. It was a cooperative study, included the department, local governments, tribes, the Bureau of Reclamation. So that initiated in 1993. In 1995, there was a lot of argument, if you will, about the use of groundwater, particularly in the Deschutes Basin, and its impact on surface water. And while on the one hand you may be protecting the surface water for the scenic waterway in a vacuum over here, if you're continuing to issue groundwater permits and they're affecting the surface water, it seems like there needs to be some conjunctive management of that permitting activity. And so one way to move forward instead of be all bound up in 1995 was Senate Bill 1033. And what that did was allow uses of groundwater to continue while making efforts to protect the scenic waterway. And what it required the department to do is to review new groundwater applications moving forward in time to ensure that they do not measurably reduce the flow of the scenic waterway. Now, the statute specifically described what measurably reduced means, and this is actually a very important point. It meant if that groundwater use individually or cumulatively reduced stream flow by 1% or 1 cubic foot per second, whichever is less. And as permits went out the door beginning in 1995, they were conditioned to say, if we find in the future that the flows of the scenic waterway are measurably reduced through additional analysis, you may be regulated off, or your use may be reduced. And the statute also says that once we meet the measurably reduced criterion, that any new groundwater right would need to provide mitigation in order to get a permit. So that was in 1995. 1996, we issued a couple other in-stream water rights in the basin just to sort of get the issues even more stacked up and complicated. And in 1998, based on this study, this groundwater study between the department and the U.S. Geological Survey and others, we concluded through that study that the groundwater in the study area discharged, for the most part, into the Deschutes River above Lake Billy Chinook, and that the consumptive use of groundwater affected the flow of the Deschutes River. And based on that conclusion, the measurably reduced standard was triggered because we have so many applications awaiting to be permitted that we had reached the 1% or the 1 CFS. We actually have reached both. And so the measurably reduced standard had been triggered in about 1998. Now, that triggering of that criterion set a whole bunch of events into motion, including the bringing together of a group known as the... Yes.
A minute. And understand this, help us understand
okay.
this a little more. The use of groundwater measurably affected the flow level of the Deschutes River. Is that what we're...
Well, Chair Jensen, the department has always understood and interpreted measurably reduce to not mean that you actually have to physically measure the river and detect a reduction, but rather that new appropriations, and in fact it says cumulatively, would affect the flow of the river by this 1 CFS or 1%, whichever is less, which of course in the Deschutes River, 1 CFS is a lot less than 1%. So if you took all of the applications pending and ran them through this very complex groundwater model that was developed by the department and the USGS, it's clear that the cumulative impact of those uses of groundwater would exceed 1 cubic foot per second of impact on the Deschutes River. And I think you recognize if you had an average flow on the Deschutes River of 4,000 or 5,000 cubic feet per second, to physically measure that kind of change would be very difficult, based even on the error band of a actual physical stream flow measurement, which could be as much as 5%. So we've never understood this statute to require that kind of physical measurement because, frankly, it's just not possible.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Of course.
Then how do we know? How do you know we've measurably altered the flow of that river? I'm confounded here. Forgive me.
Well, I appreciate your confusion, Chair Jensen, Representative Schaffler. I didn't get into the details of the 1998 Department U.S. Geological Survey groundwater study, but basically that's a study that went for many years that developed a three-dimensional quantitative model of how groundwater moves within the basin and how it affects surface water. It's a peer-reviewed study, professional study that went on for many, many years. And it's through the use of that study that we can conclude, based on years of evaluation, that we have met the measurably reduced trigger of 1 CFS. And again, the statute couldn't possibly mean that we're supposed to go out there and physically measure the 1 CFS because that's not possible to physically measure it.
I believe you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just because, number one, you're to try to apply logic as a basis of reasoning for statute, let alone water law, is doesn't make much sense because there isn't much logic in it. But I guess I just find it amazing. Others could read that statute and interpret it that's exactly what you're supposed to do is demonstrate physically the impact. And because it's difficult, maybe impossible, the decision made by the agency was that we're going to create a model and do it that way. So what we're doing basically is pure theory, not anything actual. And I'd also point out, Mr. Chair, it's true to be able to measure a 1 CFS impact on a stream the size of the Deschutes is not physically possible to do, but that would also beg the question, what the hell difference does it make? So, I guess, Mr. Chair, part of this is the fact that I sometimes have issues with agencies' interpretation of statute.
Thank you, Representative.
I just have a question, maybe a point of clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Part of it is, and I understand it's not an exact science and it's very difficult on that scale, but part of my understanding is you're looking at the cumulative impacts on the water body, on the river, on the stream, and that's my understanding why this mitigation bank was put into place, to try to come up with a way to work through these issues. And, the flip side is, I know the environmental community wasn't thrilled with this. So, theory, when you piss everybody off, then there's probably the happy medium. But I think...
Well, it only applies in divorces.
So yeah. But I think it's looking at the cumulative impacts, which... and I'm assuming you get those numbers through your modeling.
Yes, Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, that's exactly right. I mean, if you go back again to the definition of measurably reduced, it talks about the cumulative impact. And when that since we've come to the conclusion of this hydraulic connection, if you will, we have over 70 applications pending in front of the department, which have a potential consumptive use of over 70,000 acre feet. So that's exactly right. I mean, it is the cumulative impact. And I have to say that going through the rulemaking for several years and discussing this, you know, do you need to physically measure it or not issue, while there may have been a couple of people that argued that's what the statute meant, I think most people involved in this for this length of time did not interpret it to mean the department had to physically measure.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Representative Shaw.
So just so I have this right, you can fairly accurately measure the amount that is being used and then take that and compare it to an estimate of how much you believe is going through the river, and from that come to the conclusion that 1 CFS or 1% impact has been reached. Is that correct?
Chair Jensen, Representative Shaw, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And again, using a peer-reviewed, you know, multi-dimensional, very complex groundwater model.
And then Mr. Chair,
please?
How did we get to the 1% number? How did we get there?
Chair Jensen, Representative Schaffler, that was part of Senate Bill 1033 from the 1995 legislative session. And I think there may be more discussion this session about the 1 CFS 1% standard. Because if you think about it, the way that's set up, it's actually more restrictive the larger the river. And going back to Representative Cruz's discussion about the logic nature of water law, that's certainly a provision that to some people just doesn't make any sense.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I know there's been studies of the relationship of groundwater to surface water. I'm personally at this point not convinced that we know all that we need to know about that relationship. Even though the federal government said they finished the study, I still have reservations, especially on the east side of the state where most everything subsurface is volcanic in nature. So, just a comment.
Thank you, Representative. A couple of questions, I think, Adam. First one maybe is, where is this to be considered? What bill? Is there a bill? Or are you just trusting that this inquisitive group is going to want to
know? No, Chair Jensen, I have seen a bill that I can't recall the number right now, but there is a bill that instead of measurably reduced being 1 CFS or 1%, whichever is less, I think the bill would make it say just 1%. But I'm sorry, I don't recall the number.
That's fine. The other question in relationship to this issue, is there any consideration being given to the return flow from irrigation through the you know, does the model include this? And additionally, does the model include then the effect of that return flow from irrigation having on the temperature of the Deschutes?
Chair Jensen, the way the department and the model that it uses to determine whether we got to measurably reduce looks only at the consumptive use portion of a water use. So it only subtracts out, if you will, that portion of the water that is lost to evapotranspiration or other sorts of activities. So it does account for the fact that maybe half of a irrigation use returns back to the stream. So yes, that is accounted for. I don't have an answer for you on the second part in terms of the temperature effects. I don't believe the model was really looking at those kind of thermal dynamics, but more quantity issues.
Okay.
Just to move ahead through the story, scenic waterway was established, scenic waterway flows were established, measurably reduced standard was established, we determined this connection and measurably reduced had been met, which meant now we were in a situation which, based on existing law from 1995, the department was in a position to require mitigation for new groundwater permits. And so we worked with a group within the Deschutes Basin for a number of years trying to come up with a comprehensive basin-wide solution. There was also some legislation to help move things along. Again, House Bill 2184 that allowed the banking of mitigation credits to sort of facilitate people being able to get new water uses. And finally, after many years of rulemaking, in September of 2002, the Water Resources Commission adopted rules both to implement the requirements for acquiring a new water right and the obligation for mitigation and establishing mitigation banks within the basin. And again, I think the bottom line for this whole story is that based on existing law, a law that goes back to 1995, that pending a new applications need to provide mitigation in order to move forward. As we move through the rulemaking, there was three objectives. One was to protect the flows of the Deschutes River for the scenic waterway and the in-stream water rights. The other was the group that we worked with in the basin was particularly interested in restoring flow to the Middle Deschutes River. And finally, trying to meet the basin's water supply needs and to advance the department's goals of both water supply and stream flow restoration. So after many, many years of rulemaking and attempts to have sort of process-light, flexible rules, what the Commission's rules ended up with are very conservative rules with lots of opportunity for public review and interagency consultation. And I think the important thing to point out is that the rules ensure a number of things, that the mitigation for a new use be in place prior to a permit being issued, that the quantity of water put in stream for mitigation matches the quantity of water for a new consumptive use, that the mitigation occur within the location of impact, and that the mitigation be effective. There's also all kinds of monitoring and evaluation and reporting requirements. House Bill 2184, Representative Dingfelder, is very specific about the types of reporting requirements that mitigation banks must go through in terms of reporting with the department. For your information, I've attached to this memo some highlights of the rules rather than going through them. They're pretty extensive and so that's attached to the memo.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dinko.
Thank you. I just want to clarify, is the district implementing the bank, or is that done through a nonprofit, or are you contracting that out?
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, that so far we've chartered one bank. The rules require the commission to approve the charter. The first charter is with the Deschutes Water Exchange. So they'll be the ones that will be the first mitigation bank within the Deschutes Basin. And we also have an application for a mitigation bank charter from Central Oregon Irrigation District as well. So we may have two mitigation banks before long.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So the fees that they generate through these, how does it pay for itself, basically? Is there a fee that's charged? Because there's obviously some staff in administering this. Your staff is not actually administering the bank. It's the water exchange, and how do they fund that?
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, that's correct. The state doesn't sponsor or run the bank. It's basically a private enterprise, if you will. Frankly, I'm not quite sure how they charge for their services, but of course they'll be charging for services to facilitate transactions and at the same time be selling mitigation credits, and the cost of that credit will be determined, I would assume, by some sort of market forces that the state will not be involved with.
Thank you.
Well, that really concludes my comments. We believe that the rules do what we hoped they would accomplish, and that as we implement them, we believe that we'll find that these rules will support economic development and stream flow restoration activities in the Deschutes Basin, and we look forward to working through the process to implement the rules.
Okay. Does anyone have any further questions? Is there anyone else, or is there anyone in the audience that has ideas or thoughts on this issue that they would like to share with the committee?
Jerry.
Yes, Jerry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I am representing the Oregon Groundwater Association. I am here just to kind of clarify a couple of points that Adam made. The bill that we brought up, 1033 in the 95 session, was an answer to the issue that was confronting the department. They were not issuing any permits in or above a scenic waterway throughout the state, not limited just to Deschutes Basin, but everywhere. So our attempt at that legislation was to produce a piece of legislation that would say, in the essence of groundwater, we want to move some of the permits off surface water into groundwater because, in fact, they will have less of an impact on our surface water flows. During the discussion of that bill, we came up with the idea of measurably reduce. The full intent of our discussions was to come up with some type of physical method of measurably reducing the stream flow. In other words, going out and sticking a stick in a stream and saying, is in fact this causing a problem or is this a theoretical issue? During that discussion by all the various interest groups, it became rather confusing about how do you do that and what happens if you measure it one day and 20 years later it's a different figure. And that's where the compromise issue came up of one cubic foot or some type of accumulated impacts. We also came up with the theory of using mitigation because one of the thoughts was, well, okay, if you produce all these groundwater permits and then you find out later that, in fact, there was a cause there that you didn't have knowledge of, should there be some way to mitigate that effect? And yes, we thought that was a reasonable idea. The problem with groundwater is it's such an extremely complex issue. You can't merely say that groundwater moves from surface water within a given set of a stream area. You may have water coming out of the stream. You may have water going in the stream. You may have water going underneath the stream. So what you have to do in these very complex geological models and try to do some of these investigations is come up with some overall model of how this system works. The Deschutes Basin model by no means was universally met with acceptance from the geological community. Many of the geologists that I represent thought that some of the conclusions in the report was flawed by the data. So it wasn't uniformly embraced. However, one of the things that we thought was a good offshoot of this thing is that everybody wants to improve stream flows, and if we can do anything to improve stream flows, we were very supportive of that mechanism. So I just wanted to clarify Adam's point. When we did produce the legislation, that was our intent, was to try and come up with a absolute measurement, physically saying measurably reduced. Knowing how difficult that is in a large body of water, we recognize that problem. But again, the issue that we had is, well, what about climatic changes? I mean, all of a sudden you may have a river going up or going down, you don't know. So that was the mitigation issue. Was our hedge was trying to say, well, if in fact we guessed wrong and everything didn't come together, then maybe there was another mechanism of doing that. So I just want to alert the committee that this is a very extremely complex case of how you try to deal with water. One of the reasons you don't want to use this term conjunctive use, in other words, saying water and surface water are interconnected. In many cases, they aren't connected. In some cases, they are. So in the essence of the whole hydrologic cycle where water enters the earth, gets out, comes down to the ocean, comes up in clouds again, and then rains again, everything is connected. But realize when you talk about groundwater, you have to manage it in a whole different mechanical means than you do with surface water because of the complexity and all the things that come with it. So I just want to come up here and clarify that that was our intent when we were producing that statute, was to come up with some type of limiting factor of measurably reduced instead of getting into hypothetical issues. How you do that, yeah, we recognize that was a very difficult problem. And I frankly don't know how you do some of that. And that was the essence of where that 1 cubic foot per second came up with, from, and that wasn't from our side of the group, it was from another side of the interest groups that were being represented at the table. So I hope that clarifies it to some degree.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Any questions? A question or two. Is it the Water Resource Department we would go to get a list of the scenic waterways?
Yes, Chair Jensen, we'd be happy to provide a list of scenic waterways throughout the state.
I'm just wondering, as the Columbia River goes through the gorge, which is a, is that declared a scenic waterway?
Chair Jensen, my understanding is that the Columbia River is, I do not believe, is a state scenic waterway, but I can double check and get you that information.
Okay. I'd be interested. Yes, Jerry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have those figures right off the top of my head, but I seem to recollect that approximately 70% of the state was in or above a scenic waterway, and that was a complexity at the time because all those water permits were being stacked up at the department prior to 55 because they couldn't make a determination in their minds whether or not this had some type of impact. So it's a huge surface volume of land that's involved because in or above a scenic waterway is a lot of area. A lot of area of the state is in or above the Sandy Basin, for one. Deschutes Basin, of course, that we all know, but there's many, many other rivers that are a scenic waterway designation, and in or above it is a lot of physical area.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to have that if you would.
Yes.
Are there any other questions of the group? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Anyone else would like to add to this discussion? Hearing none, we are adjourned.